Got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Folta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here, as always. Kevin, what's going on? How are you?
Oh, nothing very much. Everything's going great. We are releasing Talking Biotech podcast number 300 tomorrow.
Well, this week. Give us a preview. What are you talking about?
Well, it's an interview with me. It was Allie Kennedy, who's my former student, and we talk about some of the things that have happened over the last 5 years that I've been kind of quiet about, and that just includes like the things that were canceled, the what we learned in discovery from the lawsuit against the New York Times, some of the slimy things that happened that I really kind of never talked about much, and it's pretty cool to talk. It helps. Describe why things are where they are. And it's kind of sad in a way, but still really nice to finally get that information out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if you guys haven't heard that episode, by the time you hear this one, you should go check it out, because it sounds like you're going to give some insight into how you kind of grappled with all these issues that you were just kind of thrown in your lap. So maybe that's good for people to know.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. It kind of is the underlying theme is, how do you survive when you're Google dead? So in other words, things are said in populations of 50 million, they're said in venues that reach millions of people and they're permanent. How do you rise above that and remain relevant? How do you do it when you're, being downloaded a few thousand times a week for the content that you create? And it's a really interesting question. So it's worth a listen.
Yes, do it. And I suspect one of the answers is just keep doing what you're doing and putting out good stuff. So let's do that. Let's talk about some cool science stories. So first up, it's banned in Europe fallacy, how advocacy groups weaponize the EU's questionnaire bans on genetic engineering and chemicals. Next, pregnant women's brains show troubling signs of stress, but feeling strong social support can break those patterns. And finally, is there a debate over glyphosate? The Conversation recently published a pretty bad article on the weed killer. We're going to dive into that as well. But first up, Kevin, this is closely related, actually, but this banned in Europe fallacy. Why don't tell us about this story?
Yeah, actually, very well related. All three stories kind of have a tie, as usual. This is an interesting one, because how many times do we see, and it doesn't matter what we're talking about, someone come up with a reason to reject a given technology? It's always that it's banned in blank, and usually Europe. And there's some reason that it's like some reason Europe must get it right, because, I don't know that many things that Europe, it seems like they've got their problems too, right? And when you look at issues over there, they make plenty of mistakes. And so the banned in Europe fallacy is one that I hear constantly, especially with respect to agriculture, where they get kind of a halo for doing it right. And the most recent example of this was where they talk about the AstraZeneca vaccine, where people would say, it's been banned in Europe. Well, it wasn't banned in Europe. It was put on a temporary hold while we study it. And so when you drill down further on pretty much anything like glyphosate, it's not banned in Europe. When you look at genetic engineering, it's not banned, or GM crops, it's not banned in Europe. Spain grows an awful lot of them. It's just that there are more nuances to that discussion, that, that last one's the best example. Spain grows lots of GG corn, but they grow really old lines of seed that they stopped approving new ones. And so all the seed companies pulled back all their applications for approval. So it really isn't a ban as much as you know, just the there's much more nuance than things are banned there, so we shouldn't do them.
By the way, this was an article originally published by The Logic of Science and then reprinted at GOP. But yeah, I totally agree with you, Kevin. I think the funniest part to me is that they never explained the deliberations that went into the ban or went into the pause in the case of the shot you're talking about. And if people knew some of the nitty gritty details, it wouldn't be as sexy and they wouldn't be as scared, because they would see that Europe is dominated by these activist groups that we talk about. And they have many friends in the European Parliament and in the governments of the EU member states. And so you see science kind of pushed aside. You see politics, you know, take the front seat. And if people were aware of that, I don't think it would be as good. But it is very interesting that they would go, well, look, I mean, you know, Europeans ban stuff, and they can't be wrong, can they? You know, it's a very interesting tactic, and it must be effective because they keep doing it.
Yeah, and if you talk to scientists in Europe, they don't feel the same way as the politicians. And I have so many friends over in Europe who just decry the horrible restrictions that they use on technology. And it's not really a fallacy, really, that's known, like the banned in Europe fallacy. It really is a appeal to authority. That's really what kind of fallacy this is. That, well, since this authority, which Europe doesn't ever get anything wrong, I can think of a few historical.
I'm not going to say the word, but everyone knows the word that I have in mind.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're not going, what is the hypothesis? I can't remember the guy's name now. It's the Gottlieb hypothesis or something like that. Anyway.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, the Goddard rule or something. Right. Anyway. Yeah. Yeah. Europe is not immune from making particularly bad tragedies.
Okay. Back on a serious note, I see this sort of logic applied to other issues, and they do it in the U.S. too. So we'll talk about this later. But they do this with court cases. You know, people will say, you know, a jury said that this pesticide causes cancer. So there you go. I mean, it's a jury, it's a lawsuit. And again, if people realize that it's a bunch of tort lawyers filing lawsuits with the help of activist groups, that's not as convincing. And we've talked about why in the past. But the most interesting example, I think, was a couple of years ago, the Center for Food Safety, our dear friends who we talk about all the time, they filed suit against a handful of companies to try to get some neonicotinoid insecticides off the market. And as part of the lawsuit, the companies voluntarily pulled several poorly selling products off the shelves, and they withdrew the registration. And the EPA said, that's fine, no big deal. You know, we can't force you to sell your products. So CFS came out and they said, oh, this is a huge victory. You know, congratulations. We're protecting the environment, blah, de, blah. But in reality, it was nothing of the sort. It was all hype. And what they were trying to do was say, look, I mean, the EPA pulled these off the market, so these must be harmful. You know, it's that same kind of silly argument.
Yeah, you know, what's really interesting about this, I just kind of thought about, is the reason it works is because of the penetration in social media that the activist groups have. And the fact that they can project the fallacy of these arguments from authority, you know, or at least presumed authority, and make it look like, well, the jury said, or Europe says, or the government of Peru says. And that's the reason it works, is because social media is such a great way to spread the false information and the false appeal to authority.
Here's a quote from the story. This, I think, perfectly sums up how to think about these kind of issues. Then we can move on to our next topic. But the author says, even scientists on government agencies can make bad calls. So ideally, we should base our views on the evidence, not the source of the evidence. I think that perfectly sums it up. And there was recently, just for example, a survey of EPA staff of, you know, how do you feel the agency does? Do you feel that the agency puts out good scientific analysis? And overwhelmingly, a majority of them said, we are regularly overrided by the leadership, whether it's Republicans or Democrats. You know, so whatever the politics of the day is, that takes precedent over whatever scientific work we do. And so, again, just to sum up, you know, follow the evidence. That's the best way to do it. But let's move on, Kevin. What's up with pregnant women's brains?
Yeah, this was really interesting, and I thought this was kind of cool that when you so women who are with child have a typical level of stress, and this is particularly bad in the third trimester, that there's this ability or this vulnerability to react to stress in different ways. It seems to get worse hormonally, probably, you know, and we all know the effects of hormones on the way people feel. And so this is something that happens. So the group that's done this, and I've neglected to mention the names of the authors again. Jeez, you know, I'm absolutely awful. This is a couple of researchers at Texas. Hold on, let me tell you where. Texas A&M. So professional at Texas A&M University. It's Rebecca Brooker, who's an associate professor, and Tristan Nyman, a PhD student. And they speak about the vulnerability that women have. And they looked at this with the EEG. They used an EEG to analyze how women responded to different stimuli. And what you could show is that most women, when they were hooked up, if you gave them a negative sound, that you would have a certain response, and that other sounds are neutral. So a negative sound might be like, you know, a screaming baby or a barking dog or something like that. A neutral sound, you know, something a little more gentle, and that there was more response to so basically a stronger response typically to the negative sound. But in the third trimester of pregnancy, that is different, where a negative image is perceived very strongly, but so are neutral images. So it seems like even things that shouldn't trigger a response do trigger a response. And this was really what was very interesting, was just this laying the foundation of this, was that there was a reaction that was coming from a heightened reaction that was happening because of the pregnancy itself.
This story was spot on. Just from my experience over the last year, this was so, it really was helpful to get sort of a scientific insight into what my wife is dealing with, you know, because I've always loved and respected her, but to watch her go through this, it's incredible. You know, that this is a task that, you know, half the population can't possibly understand, you know, but the thing that I noticed that was most irritating to her, it seemed, is that everybody's an expert on pregnancy and child rearing. As soon as you tell them you're pregnant, they're like, oh, you know what? You know, you got to do this, and you got to use this kind of formula, and blah, de, blah, de, blah. And my wife is a science teacher and pretty smart woman in general. And it just drove her nuts, you know, because she's doing her homework. We're doing our homework. And then everyone tells you stuff, and a lot of it's bad in terms of its effect, but then it's also wrong. They're giving you bad information. And so all that to say, I thought this was incredibly useful. This is a great kind of research for people to be doing.
Yeah, and she's in the last decimester.
Yeah, we're possibly days away, so yeah.
Yeah, so but what's interesting about this is that the responses that they were seeing and the magnitude of the responses that they were measuring are different in women who have a perception of support, social support. So that level of stress is very different when these social support networks exist. And that's not really surprising. I think that pregnancy always was more of a, we're probably the more isolated than we've ever been in terms of family and other resources, in terms of, you know, social support for pregnant women than we've ever had. But it does say that it is really just this perception of support. Doesn't even have to be actual support. And so the punchline of the entire thing was that you could improve maternal and child outcomes, because children, you know, the fetus does have some vulnerability as well, because they're bathing in the hormones the mom secretes The stress hormones, the cortisol, they move through the placenta. And that it doesn't mean that we have to actually go support pregnant women. What we have to do is help them understand the benefits that they have, you know, and the support network they have, and build the idea that, you know, here are all these people who are looking out for you. You know, it sounds a little cheesy, but I think that that's what the authors suggest.
Well, more importantly, I think that's what the evidence shows too. And that's a big deal, at least in my opinion, it's a big deal, because for the longest time, society generally thought of mental health issues or anything psychological as sort of like not related to medicine. It was more like, you know, just get over it or buck up or, you know, life's tough and pick yourself up by your bootstraps. But I think research like this shows that your emotions and how you feel and how you perceive the world are intimately connected to the rest of your physical body, you know, and it's good to have that understanding of how everything is connected, biologically speaking.
Yeah, I think that's true. And it shows the power of social networks, like not social networks like social media, but because, you know, I've worked with so many pregnant women over the years. When you're in science, you have a lot of women who, as graduate students or postdocs, it kind of is the best time for them to take the time to have the child, because they can get some time to, you know, to take care of it in its earlier time, rather than doing that during a, you know, faculty or early career position. And so I've worked with so many women who've been pregnant during that window. And one thing they all shared, and they all came from different countries, different social backgrounds, whatever, they all shared that they wanted to be in the laboratory until that baby was on the other side, because it's so funny. I mean, that's one thing that they would come to work looking so uncomfortable. And, you know, we're talking like eight months and 29 days and red in the face and blood vessels popping in their eyes, and they can barely breathe when they walk. You say, why don't you stay home and rest? And they're like, no way, I'm staying here. I want to be around everybody. So there's something to that.
Yes. Yeah. It's really interesting. Just a final thought. I keep thinking of stuff. As we speak, my wife is teaching high school cheerleaders how to do a pyramid. And at first it drove me nuts. I'm like, you know, this, like, he could come at any minute. Like, you got to be somewhere close where I can get you to the hospital. And now that I look at this, I go, oh, that's crucially important for her to have some kind of normalcy and some kind of interaction with other people, you know? So,
yeah, I hope really, she only is the bottom of the pyramid.
She more just like tells the girls, like, you're doing it wrong, and then scolds them, and they go, we're sorry.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a very hands-off kind of a thing. Anyway. All right, Kevin, you're the scientist here. Is there a debate in the scientific community about glyphosate and all the harms it could cause?
I wouldn't call it a debate. There is a discussion of glyphosate that continues in the scientific literature about its strengths and weaknesses, its applications, and its considerations. The things it does well and the things that we have to be careful of. Those are the things that are a ongoing discussion. But there's not a debate about, is it dangerous? It's like anything. It's like from screwdrivers to nuclear power. It's how you use it, and that dictates its problems, you know. And so this is really what is happening with glyphosate.
I see. Okay. And it's good to have that insight, because we're talking about it's an article I wrote, actually. But The Conversation is a generally excellent website for science commentary. But they published a few days ago an article by three geographers of any specialty, three geographers, and they were talking about the potential harms of glyphosate. And you know, correct me if I'm wrong, Kevin, but I think they hit more or less every single activist trope. You know, they talked about glyphosate in cereal, and they talked about covering every acre of farmland in a half pound of glyphosate. And they talked about, you know, it might cause cancer. And they mentioned the International Agency for Research on Cancer, like every possible activist claim, they brought it out. And superficially, they had support for this in some of the scientific literature. But to somebody who knows the topic, this article was just obviously from the get-go utterly incorrect.
Yeah, and this is really disappointing because I love the conversation and I published a lot there. Well, I published things there. And really what this article did was it went through the activist websites and went through all of the supporting literature. And if it said in the title or in the abstract that it affected the microbiome of bees, it became, oh, look, it's affecting bees and it's a pesticide, when they didn't actually go through the data and didn't actually go through the science. And this became really problematic, especially because they were making claims from activist websites, namely Moms Against America. Or no, Moms Across America.
No, you got it right the first time.
It really is true. That was the best Freudian slip I ever had. It's Moms Across America that this group, you know, they did errant tests by using a competitive ELISA with breast milk that you can't use with breast milk. You have to use, you just can't do it for lots of reasons I've spoken about many times. Breast milk is a very complicated matrix that you have to be able to handle correctly and analyze correctly in order to get the correct result. And the correct work was done by Dr. Shelley McGuire, and she did not find it. And she's a lactation specialist. So they chose to post an article saying there's a debate when there really is no debate, where they then cherry pick a activist article from an anti-glyphosate group and put that above the real science that was there. And that just to me says there's an agenda cooking here. And when you go through the entire thing and you saw the article on the bees, you know, they mentioned that, you know, the microbiome of bees, the microbiome of bees paper was not a bad paper, but it had a couple limitations. And that when they said, okay, there's a problem when we look at, so first they feed bees glyphosate in the lab. They only looked at a subset of the bees that they fed. So no one knows what happens to 80% of the bees. They look at the subset and they found out that it had effects at the lowest dose, but didn't have any effect at the higher dose. So what does that mean? You know, you give it twice the level and it's not changing. So it just seemed like there's some, you know, maybe it's a good paper, but there's some room in here for other interpretations. So it just was a really low moment for the conversation, in my opinion.
Well, let's go over a couple other examples, because I went through all the literature they cited when I wrote this article. I wanted to make sure I was, you know, like if I'm going to critique somebody, I'm going to make sure that I'm doing it correctly. So they cited a paper in mice, and they said that glyphosate had multi-generational effects. And maybe you can talk more about the genetics of that. But I looked at the paper, and if you look at the methods, they gave the animals a massive dose of glyphosate. And as you pointed out in an email, because I was asking you about this, it was for an extended period of time. And if you give an animal a chemical that they're not really supposed to have, even if it's not strictly speaking dangerous, it's going to have some biological effect and possibly a negative one. And so the fact that you can do that in a laboratory setting in an animal model that doesn't really prove anything about its risk to humans. You know what I'm saying? So can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure. And part of the thing is that when you're poisoning an animal with anything, you don't know if the effect you're measuring is coming from the drug itself or an nth order developmental or physiological consequence of that. So in other words, if you give a little bit of the drug and you see a response, you can trust it. But if you give something a drug for 6 months and then at the end of 6 months, see this animal is really sick, and then you look at its whatever and realize that its physiology is out of whack, it isn't that the drug caused it. It's that chronic exposure to the drug at extremely high rates allowed a condition where this was a difference you would measure physiologically. It's really important to distinguish the difference. Just for, I guess the best analogy is, you know, if you hit something, you hit a mouse with a hammer every day, at the end of 30 days, the gene expression levels between the control unhit hamster and the other one are going to be very different. It doesn't mean that hammers cause kidney damage. It means the mouse is dead and injured. You just got to go sometimes to the absurd. But that's really what that paper showed. And it wasn't a bad paper again, but it had some severe limitations as to what you could really take home and interpret from it.
Sure. And by the way, I'm not slamming the authors of that paper. They specifically said in their conclusion, we did this study to show that we could do it, so we can recognize that this is a possibility worth investigating further. They weren't saying right. We did this and therefore what you're about to read in the conversation is that, your grandkids are going to develop issues if you use glyphosate. That wasn't the point of the study. But one other example, because this was egregious, this was arguably the worst part of the study, is they said that glyphosate could cause liver and kidney failure. And for the liver data specifically, it came from a study with rats, and it came from Giles Eric Seralini's lab. And the original data was in a paper that was retracted in 2012. They didn't mention this in the conversation article. And it was just sort of taken like, oh yeah, this is just another study that you can find on PubMed. And that's ridiculous. So can you talk a little bit more about that? There were a lot of problems with that paper. I don't want to relitigate that, but
yeah, I'll just suffice it to say, it just was poor scholarship. And you shouldn't just go and find the data that supports your argument and ignore everything else. And that's really a dangerous place for this author team to go. They're all assistant professors, and it seems as though it's probably not the best route to put stuff. The conversation is an academic publishing outlet, and putting something into that outlet that sullies the name of the conversation and the credibility of the conversation, but ultimately affects your credibility, is really a bad move. So they really need to look at things a little more carefully before writing articles like this. And we could talk more about that, but what else did you find in the article that was particularly problematic?
Almost everything, as I said in the story, like at every line, there was something atrocious. I mean, they did the classic, you can cover the world in glyphosate if you were to add up all of the active ingredient that's used annually. And yeah. I don't understand the point of that. It's like, if you add up all the sugar that's eaten every year, you could drown someone in sugar, it's so useless to do that. And I quoted Steve Savage, who's a plant pathologist who does great work. But in the article that I cited of his, he said, for any kind of plant protection product, farmers use something like 3 ounces to 64 ounces of active ingredient. And it's mixed with a bunch more water. And then that's used for an area the size of a football field, roughly, which is about what they're talking about in that story. You know what I'm saying? So in other words, the products are expensive. Farmers don't want to use them if they don't have to. And they use them very sparingly as a result. And so the fact that they would say, if you could, add up all the glyphosate, you could build a house out of glyphosate or whatever, it's a pointless metric, and it's designed to scare people.
Well, when you say that you could put a half pound on every farm field in the world, that's not so bad. I mean, a half pound, let's see, what weighs a half pound? I don't even know. Two, the meat and 2 quarter pounders. Grind that up over an acre and get an idea of just how much of a threat that is for a relatively innocuous compound. It's usually about 750 milliliters or 75 grams of active ingredient per acre. And it's 60 milligrams per square meter, basically. I've done all the math on that. It's an extremely small amount. And so the amount that's there, shouldn't concern us too much.
Sure. And it's just, as a comparison, it's sloppy and it doesn't help clarify what the topic is about. But here's my biggest problem, and then I'll stop talking. And I've said this over and over, I feel like a broken record at this point, but when mainstream publications, whether it's The Conversation or Scientific American or whatever, when you give a platform to this stuff that is really fringe and it's like the public doesn't need to be concerned about a sloppy study in rat livers. You know what I'm saying? So right. when you give people a platform like this, there are people paying attention to these debates who are climate change skeptics, and maybe they're vaccine skeptics. And I know a lot of these people, and I know they're watching what happens with glyphosate. And so when you give a platform to something that's associated with this progressive environmental political movement, what you tell all these people is that they're allowed to, you know, ignore the science when they want to, you know? So if they want to say, well, you know, maybe climate change isn't caused by humans, or maybe there are problems with the new COVID vaccines, you know what I'm saying? So you can't tell everyone follow the science, and then, you know, for your particular bias, it's okay, because it's okay because it's my bias. You know, we have to do this consistently, or you're not going to do what you, I assume, want to do, which is promote science literacy across the whole society.
Whew. That's right. No, you're exactly right. And this is why it's particularly dangerous for them to be able to entertain work like this. What's really interesting is if you dig a little deeper, and when you said, you know, earlier, and a lot of people have said, well, why are people in geography departments writing these articles? It turns out that geography departments are pretty diverse. And the authors who are in this are folks who are working in geography of global trade, and geography of food systems, and geography of food equity, and geography of of economics and populations. And some of the folks, when you read their websites, it's pretty clear that they are not necessarily unbiased in their feelings towards glyphosate. That that they're one of the authors is a in for sustainable food systems and food politics and agrarian change. You know, her most recent article her most recent article is Generic and Growing Green, the Changing Political Economy of the Global Pesticide Complex. So whereas they may study these topics, which is totally cool, I get it, but you have to have the, especially when writing as a professor, you must maintain the scholarship of carefully vetting the work that you cite. Because if you're citing it because it came off of, you know, Moms Across America's website, that's not good scholarship. And ultimately, you're going to damage your own career by citing it. You need to attach your name to the best quality science, the best quality. And if you're going to cite it, you have to say, you know, here's why it affects bees, but we're concerned about the dose response that remains to be resolved. There's data that say it's in breast milk, but those data can't really be believed because the best tests done properly do not support them. I mean, you know, you need to be scientifically correct, because this is a bad thing to hit your wagon to in terms of a faculty member in a tenure track position.
Sure, sure. And we should give them a little bit of credit, because they did retract the statement about glyphosate and breast milk. I mean, the article, frankly, in my opinion, should not have been published because it was so bad, but at least the conversation looked at the comments that you and I think it was Mary Mangan were making. And they said, okay, well, maybe we should delete that. So they deleted one thing out of like 30 that were that were wrong with the story. So I'll give them credit for that. But another thing, one of the authors, she's an assistant professor of geography, but she's on the board of advisors at the Agroecology Fund. And this group, if you're not familiar with them, they spend millions of dollars trying to keep genetically engineered crops out of Africa. And as we've talked about, this is really, really harmful to the farmers over there, to the consumers over there, because these are useful tools that they can utilize to grow enough food so they can maybe stop living a subsistence lifestyle. It's a big deal, you know? And to her credit, she told people this. But I think it's important for more people to be aware of where this is coming from. It doesn't make her wrong, as we just said. She's wrong because she's wrong. But I think she might have been a little bit biased in what she was citing because of who she's affiliated with.
There you go. And that last paper, I was just looking at it here while you were talking about the, you know, who her other affiliations. It was published in the Journal of Peasant Studies. and just over on the other side, I saw a name I recognized. It said Mewa Montenegro, who was the one who said that the food evolution video or the food evolution documentary was just activist propaganda. And she published in the same journal, next also a paper. So it just It just was an interesting coincidence, but you know, your point is well taken. These are folks who have other affiliations and agenda that really do that are not necessarily looking carefully at the science as much as their agenda, and that's something the conversation should be immune to.
Yeah, they should. And I wish more people were talking about this. It didn't garner the kind of response that I thought it would. You know, if it was like, if it was a climate denial thing, everyone else would be falling over themselves to talk about how stupid the story was. But no one seems to be particularly interested in this. But in any event, we'll leave it there. Who are you following? On Twitter?
Someone I should have mentioned a long damn time ago. I would recommend following at Kara Santa Maria. And Kara is, she's been in the world of science and skepticism for a long time. She was the science editor at the Huffington Post when I first met her almost a decade ago. And she currently is a co-host on the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast, but also a lot of other local television in Los Angeles, including some daily stuff now. So she is somebody who I always thought was a rising star in science communication and science, who really does a great job and did a nice job in posting really relevant, interesting stuff. So she's a good one to follow.
Yeah, that's great. I think I actually saw her on Joe Rogan's podcast a couple years ago, and I remember her being very smart and very helpful in what she was talking about. So yeah, great recommendation. And I'm going to recommend people follow Dr. Josh Bloom, who is a chemist at the American Council on Science and Health. I work with him pretty frequently. But Josh is kind of a weirdo in that he goes into CVS's with his camera out and he snaps pictures of homeopathic drugs. And then he writes articles about why CVS shouldn't be selling them. So in one of the more recent articles he wrote, he found that these products, which aren't supposed to have active ingredients, have active ingredients.
Right.
And then they don't. And on top of that, the active ingredient doesn't do what the front of the box says it's supposed to do. And so I think he's almost gotten kicked out of multiple drugstores for doing this. So,
okay, good for him. Cause this is something that has had me for years, that you could go into Walgreens or CVS and right underneath the sign that says cough and cold, there's a box of Airborne. No, I'm serious. This drives me nuts. They say the homeopathic remedy for whatever. And my dad was not feeling well, and he's an older guy, and you know, he should get medical care. And he goes into Walgreens and he doesn't even buy the name brand Airborne. He buys the Walborne. He buys the Walborne, and then he says, "Yeah, this stuff doesn't do anything. This is crap. Yeah, this stuff is totally useless." And I go, "Yeah, it didn't work because it doesn't have any active ingredients in it." And it's a little, it's got like a smattering of vitamins, you know, like some vitamin C and stuff. And he was really, you know, my dad's a really smart guy, and he was really surprised to find out that you could basically sell a pill or a formulation of nothing and put that under a cough and cold sign.
Yeah. It's crazy. I also learned from, I don't know if it was the same story. It might've been. But he was saying that the big pharmaceutical companies as well, they will switch out active ingredients that are actually worse. They have a less helpful effect. If you have the sniffles or something, and they say now with blah, 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 and it's a big fancy chemical name. So people go, oh, that must be the new and improved. And in reality, it's just a cheaper ingredient that they can mass produce, you know? So anyways, we will, we'll leave it there. Thank you guys as always for listening. Follow us on Twitter as well, at Kevin Folta, at Cam J English. Retweet the show, post it on Facebook when it comes out, and leave us reviews. We love reviews, only good ones. And we will see you next week. Thank you so much.